This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Rogue World, Book 7 in the Undying Mercenaries series. Written by B.V. Larson, performed by Mark Boyette. Great empires are not maintained by timidity. Tacitus, 101 A.D. Chapter 1. We all live on balls of dirt, essentially, rocky planets that form around relatively stable stars in a tight orbital band, a zone where liquid water can form on the surface. That's what we all have in common, all the beings living on one island in the sky or another. Once you've visited enough new worlds and gotten to know a few of them, it seems like one man's alien is another man's local inhabitant. I think most humans who've traveled among the stars can't help but question their place in this vast cosmos of ours when they finally return home again. Gazing out into the evening sky from my parents' back porch in Waycross, Georgia sector had left my mind full of such big thoughts. The first stars were popping into life in the heavens, and they made me think. That was unusual for me, as I normally spent my time between deployments drinking, working on farm buildings that were almost falling down, and trying to get lucky with the ladies in Waycross. But tonight felt different somehow, and it was better. After I'd teleported my daughter Etta and my mama back home from Dust World, I'd realized I'd gathered my family together in one spot for the first time. For a while, the togetherness was sheer bliss. Even Della, Etta's mother, came by now and then to check on her little girl. I wouldn't exactly call that motherly instinct, as Della had never been the nesting type. Della had good survival instincts, but socially, she was pretty disconnected for a human being. Della's behavior had always seemed downright weird to my mom, and she'd taken it upon herself to provide all the care and attention that Etta needed. The only problem was that Etta didn't really want much affection. She was the daughter of a wild woman from Dust World and me. I didn't know which one of us was responsible for any particular genetic aspect of Etta's personality, or if it was just due to a rough upbringing on Dust World, but it hardly mattered. The long and short of it was that since coming home to Earth, Etta had spent most of her time running around in the swampy forest out back of my shack. "James?" Mama asked me one muggy evening in April. "How are we going to get her into a regular school next year?" I said, giving my skull a scratch. "I'm not sure that it would be wise to even attempt such a thing. We might be liable for damage to public property, and injuries maybe. We might have to homeschool." Mama turned pale at the thought, but she didn't argue, she just sighed. She knew I was right. I felt kind of bad for her. Etta had a room painted pink in the main house, a pile of self-dressing dolls with nanite clothing, and enough pretty dresses to impress a Sunday school teacher. But she ignored all that stuff. "What's she doing out there in that bog today?" Mama asked me. "Well," I answered reluctantly, "I think she's adding to her bone collection." Etta had a fascination with bones. She found them everywhere, often digging them up with a stick or other improvised tool. It was kind of an unusual hobby for a 9-year-old girl. "She'll be a great mind someday, son," Mama said, putting up a brave front. "At least that's what I keep telling myself. She'll be an archaeologist or something." "Maybe she takes after her grandpa like that, on Della's side, I mean. He's the most respected scientist on Dust World."
"The investigator?"
she asked, suppressing a shudder.
"Yes, I met him a few times when I was staying out there. A ghastly man."
I figured it wouldn't help at all to admit I agreed with her. One time the investigator dissected me after Della had killed me. I'll never forget the smell and look of my own death laid bare on a slab.
"Just seems like we have so little time to enjoy moments like this," Mama said. "And when we do have time, they never quite turn out like we'd hoped. Well, I'm going in to make dinner now. Etta will come home hungry at dusk. She always does." Something in her tone made me frown and look at her. "You aren't regretting living with us, are you, Mama?" I asked. "You don't seem happy." She looked surprised. There was a sadness in her eyes, but I didn't understand it. I brought home her granddaughter, and sure, the child was a little odd, but one would think a granny could look past that.
"No, no," she said. "I'm very happy to have both of you here, more than you know, James."
She went inside then, and I stared after her in confusion. My dad came out to talk to me a moment later. He looked as long in the face as a bloodhound. That's when I began to realize something was seriously wrong. "Let me guess," I asked him as he pressed a cold squeeze bottle of beer into my hand. "It's about immigration. You broke your contract and they're giving you hell about it." He nodded slightly.
"That's part of it, actually," he said.
"Those damn chair monkeys," I growled. "It didn't cost them squat to transport Mama to Earth, but they're still trying to charge you for the trip back, aren't they?"
"Sort of," he admitted. "Your mother signed an emigration pledge, remember? They charged her very little to go out to Dust World. As long as she agreed, she'd never come back. You brought her back, James."
"So it's my fault? Should I steal another teleport suit and airmail her back out to the stars?"
"Please don't," he chuckled quietly. "Just forget about it. We'll pay the fines and make do. We don't want to burden you with our troubles. In fact, I promised your mother I wouldn't say a thing."
I stared at him for a second.
"Well, then you lied, didn't you?"
"I get it already, and I'm willing to help. I've been paying rent here, and I'll double it."
He perked up a little. "That's very generous of you, son."
"But that won't be enough, will it?"
I asked him suspiciously.
"What's really wrong? Are the hogs threatening to put you guys in jail for coming back to Earth?"
"No, but our hegemony coverage has lapsed."
"What? Your health care? You can still pay cash, right?"
He shrugged. "Let's just drop it."
I drained my beer as we watched the sun go down. Just about the time I began to get worried and the first wave of skeeters took a shot at my bare arms, Etta showed up. She was just a shadow at first, slinking around behind my shack. She came toward the house when I hollered about supper time. My dad took one look at her and exploded in laughter.
"Etta," he asked incredulously, "have you covered yourself in mud?"
"Yes," she said. "The insects here bite."
"That's right," I told her. "But you can't come into the house looking like a swamp monster. Get the hose around on the side of the house and spray off. Not onto the windows, either." We got her cleaned up, and we praised her latest bone specimens.
"Is that a dog's skull?" my dad asked in mild disgust.
"No," she said. "I think it's called a fox."
I eyed her thoughtfully.
"That's a rare animal in these woods. You sure you didn't help this fox along to becoming a pile of bones?"
She straightened up and looked indignant.
"That wouldn't be the same thing at all. Just look here, at the wear on this jaw. It's been cured in the bog for years."
We inspected it, and we both had to admit, she'd found an honest-to-God skeleton.
"What are you going to do with this one?" my father asked.
"I was thinking of reconstructing him, posing him maybe."
"Yeah?" he said.
Etta was like Della in that she didn't understand the natural squeamishness of Earth people. She didn't seem to know that her grandpa was unsure about her hobby. She was so fascinated by her collection, she probably couldn't grasp why anyone would be upset about it. Throwing a towel around her wet clothes, I led her into the house. We ate dinner, and everything seemed fine to me. Sure, Mom was a little quiet, and my dad was thoughtful, but they told me things were all right, so I didn't let their mood bother me. It wasn't until the next morning that things took a bad turn. A small hand touched my shoulder, waking me up at dawn, and that hand gave me a shake. This might not seem odd to you, but it was to me. No one got all the way into my shack without waking me up. At least not too many people did. Claver had managed it, but he'd done so using a teleport suit. Della had snuck in, too, but I'd caught her before she could lay a hand on me.
As a man who'd spent more than a decade getting killed and revived again among the stars, I developed a keen sense for danger. Even when I slept, I never really let my guard down. A part of my brain was always on the alert. Immediately upon contact, I bounced off the couch with a combat knife glittering in my hand.
"Hush," Etta said. "It's me."
Squinting and bleary-eyed, I lowered the knife.
"I told you before, girl, you can't just go sneaking up on me like that. It's not healthy for you or anyone else."
She wasn't listening, as usual. She was at the window, peering out of a tiny crack in the faded curtains.
"What's going on?" I asked. "There are men at the house. I slipped out my window and came to get you. Was I wrong? Should I have fought them myself?"
"What in the living hell are you?" I asked, coming to lean beside her and peer out. Etta was right. A white air car had landed in our driveway. Air cars were expensive. We didn't get them often out here in Waycross. My family's tram was worth maybe 1% of the value of a shiny new air car.
"I didn't even hear them land," I said.
"You have to run,"
she said, looking at me seriously.
"I'll guide you. I have several shelters in the woods nearby. We'll wait for them to leave."
"They're assuming they've come for me," she shrugged.
"Don't they always come for you?"
Etta had a point there. They usually did. I was the only one in the family that had repeatedly irked the law, although I had a sneaking suspicion that Etta might take that distinction away from me by the time she grew up.
"That emblem,"
I said, pointing at the blue-green stylized emblem of Earth that was stamped on the air car door.
"That means there's some kind of hog, local, district, maybe even sector level. What do they want?"
I sighed, threw on a shirt, and stashed my knife in my back pocket.
"I guess it's time I found out."
Walking down the short path between my place and my parents' house, I tried to calm down. There was no reason to assume that these hogs meant my family harm. But I'd had so many bad run-ins with officials like these, it was impossible not to feel a simmering sense of rage. As I walked, I repeatedly told myself I wasn't going to kill anyone, not today. It became almost a chant in my mind. What I saw when I got close erased my promises. I sprang forward, eyes blazing. My mom was on a gurney. It was a powered model, and it hovered about 2 feet off the ground as a single blue-suited attendant walked beside it. My mom looked sicker than I'd ever seen her. She had her eyes open, but they were squinting in the morning sunlight as if it pained her. "Get your hands off my maw, you hog!" I shouted. Startled, the attendant craned his neck around and his eyes bugged out. I had my combat knife out, and it was whirring with power. Twin serrated edges worked in opposite directions, ready to chew through meat and bone like warm butter.
"Who the hell are you?" the man asked.
He didn't pull a weapon or even run. He just stared at me in complete shock. He looked so startled, in fact, I didn't bother to kill him.
"Mama," I asked, "are you okay?" "Calm down, James," she said. "They're just bringing me home."
Her voice was weak and raspy. I didn't like it. Not one bit.
"What did you do to her?"
I demanded from the blue-shirt medic. He had one of those clipboard-type computers, and it was filming me.
"I'm streaming all of this," he said nervously. "Any assault will be too damn late for you,"
I finished for him.
"Now answer me."
He licked his lips and eyed my knife. I switched it off and lowered it, but still held the handle in a white-knuckled grip. Before he answered, he dared to glance toward his air car, which I now realized was outfitted to carry gurneys like the one my mom was on. He did a double take when he looked that way, though. Etta was there, stationed between the attendant and the car. There was no escape for him. She was small, but she had a knife of her own. It wasn't powered, but it looked wickedly sharp in the pink light of dawn.
"This is crazy," the attendant said. "I'm reporting all of this. You people are crazy. All I'm doing is returning this patient. We picked her up last night on an emergency call. Today, the hospital in Albany released her. That's all I know."
I looked at my mom. "Is that right, Mama?"
"Yes, you big oaf. You're getting far too carried away. Get me into the house."
She apologized to the attendant, and we got her off the gurney and into the house. The man with the air car lit out of our driveway like all the bats of hell were chasing him. That was just fine by me.
"I can't stay mad at you," she said. "It would be wrong. I should blame myself. I should have told you. What's going on? Are you sick?"
"Yes, she is," my father said from the porch. He looked old and sad, just like my mom. They were both about 60 now, and nothing shows a person's age like the morning light. We all went inside, and I helped my dad make breakfast. As we prepared our morning meal, my parents began to explain. "Your mother contracted something nasty back on Dust World," my dad said. "A poison, maybe. Or possibly a nanite infection left behind by the squids who used to plague that planet."
"Why didn't you say anything? Could you have done anything about it?"
Mama asked.
"I don't know. Maybe. Would it have made you happier to know I was sick?"
I didn't answer because the answer was obvious.
"Well,"
my dad said, "whatever it is, it's killing her, slowly."
"I have good days and bad days," Mama said. "Sometimes I have to go into Albany for a complete blood transfusion."
That sounded stupidly expensive to me, and it was.
"The hogs can cure anything," I told my parents. "There's hardly a disease out there that we haven't conquered. Hell, they could grow you a new body if they really wanted to."
My mom shrugged.
"I guess that's so, James. But everything has a price. Nothing's free. Not really."
I was in a bad mood after breakfast. I paced and muttered. They watched me, worriedly. I was glad Etta had gone out again to play in the swamp. She didn't need to see her daddy brooding. "Now, son," my dad said warily, "don't you go off and do something crazy, you hear me?"
"That notion never crossed my mind," I assured him.
I even summoned up a smile to go along with that lie, but I could tell he wasn't buying it. He knew me too damned well. Chapter 2 Later that day, I contacted Sector Office of Hegemony Care. My mom needed something better than outpatient visits. Whatever she had, it was clearly getting worse. There was supposed to be a procedure for fixing people who came down with alien pathogens, and I meant to find out how it could be done. If my mom had been a legionnaire, there wouldn't have been a problem at all. They were cleared for such things by default. It was expected that soldiers traveling to the stars might pick up any number of illnesses. Worst case, they could just recycle us. But my mom had been listed as an emigrated colonist. She wasn't even supposed to be here on Earth. The fact that she was here didn't seem to trouble anyone in Hegemony Care's bureaucracy at all. After my channel was accepted and allowed to connect, I was surprised to see the screen on my tapper stayed dark. I'd expected it to light up with a face, even if it was one of those two perfect virtual agents. But instead, it was audio only, like something from a century back. After waiting around on hold through a dozen AI voices that didn't help at all, I got a human to come on the line. That was a miracle all by itself, but even then, the story was far from over. Getting anything useful out of a government type was always difficult. "I'm very sorry, sir," the prim-sounding rep said, "but your mother has a half-share account."
"What the hell does that mean?"
"It means she must wait," he said.
"How long?"
I demanded. "My screen is giving me an estimate of 3.7 years, but I must caution you, these estimates are usually optimistic."
4 years? She'll be dead by then."
"I'm sorry, sir, but care in this category is rationed for non-essential citizens." I could feel myself losing it. The sensation of a complete breakdown and possibly violent fit was right there, already past my guts and halfway up my throat to my brain. I fought it back with difficulty. If there was one thing I knew about bureaucrats, it was that yelling at them rarely helped. "Okay," I said, making a Herculean effort to sound normal. "I want to buy up my parents' medical to a full share."
I'm sorry, sir, there aren't enough credits in their accounts to— I've got credits. I'm buying up their account myself.
The line fell quiet for a while. I heard clicking, more quiet. Then finally the agent came back on the line. It felt weird to be dealing with someone with voice-only tech. That sort of thing was antiquated in civvy life. You only ran into it when you talked to the government.
I'm sorry, sir, the man said, but the enrollment period for that action has passed for this calendar year. We can't change the nature of any service plan again until December.
It was July 8th. At this point, my face was getting hot, and I could feel it contorting uncontrollably.
Okay, I said. Forget about the insurance. I'll just pay for the treatment myself, with cash.
That size of transaction using credit coins would be illegal in your sector.
I don't mean literal cash. I'll transfer the money bank to bank.
Silence reigned again, and I heard more clicking. The guy wasn't even bothering to tell me he was going to ignore me for a while. He just stopped talking whenever he felt like it.
You're offering to pay the entire sum? He asked after a time. That's what I said, damn it.
More tapping.
The charge will be nearly 2 million hegemony credits. That's just an estimate, mind you. The real rate could rise depending on a wide variety of circumstances.
That made me gulp. I didn't have that much.
That's more than my family paid for all 5 of my years in high school, I complained.
Considerably more, I imagine. The trouble is that once you go outside the boundaries of your subsidized hegemony care package, you run into commercial pricing, which is significantly inflated.
All right, I said, closing my eyes and rubbing my face. I don't care. I can get a few extra credits with loans. That'd be okay with you assholes, wouldn't it?
Of course it would, sir, he said brightly. In fact, we're offering a special this month on long-term payment plans.
Right. Let's do it.
The line went quiet again, and after a while he began to read some kind of speech to me. The Hegemony Care Act of 2121 requires me to inform you of certain realities, he began. Sometimes, when people are in this unfortunate situation, they make emotional decisions they regret later. In short, our DataCore AI is advising against your actions today.
I frowned. What's that mean?
Well, sir, he said hesitantly, I'm obliged to inform you that your mother's life expectancy isn't guaranteed to improve in this case, even if the procedure is successful.
I understand all that, but I'm authorizing the payment on the chance that it will.
Very well, then. You've been informed of the situation, and you've waived your rights. We're all set. Report for processing at your nearest Hegemony Wellness Center within 24 hours of this call's termination. Failure to do so will result in a recalculation of the prices currently listed on your tapper.
Report for processing? I asked.
You mean me or my mom?
You, of course. You're the one taking on the financial burden. We can't perform this transaction online. You'll have to go down to the wellness center and present your case in person.
My frown had been returning, and now it grew even deeper. I'd just begun to believe this part of the nightmare was over, but something in what he'd so offhandedly said had set off an alarm inside my thick skull.
What are you talking about now? Make what case?
The case for this scheduling change, obviously. You have to understand your payment terms aren't the only consideration involved. Other citizens of greater stature are already in the priority queue.
So what?
I demanded, unable to keep my cool any longer. My voice had finally risen into a shout.
If my mom had a full share account, she'd be getting the treatment right now.
That's not what I'm talking about, sir. There are only so many of these procedures to go around. The total number has been allotted for this year. To put your mother onto the list, someone else will have to be removed. That decision has to be made by the panel governing the Hegemony Care Wellness Center.
My eyes were squinched closed by this time. He was telling me that I was offering up 2 million credits as a bribe to the government, and if they decided to take it, my mom would live because they'd let someone else's mom die. How had Hegemony Care turned into this? Such grim life or death choices, endless government regulations and accountancy. I felt sick to my guts.
The fight went out of me as I thought about the reality of pushing some other non-essential citizen over the cliff in favor of my mom.
Sir, asked the prim man on the other end of the line,
Is there anything else?
Yeah, I said. Cancel the whole damned thing. He began talking again, but I hung up. I was just going to have to find another way. Chapter 3. That evening, I tucked Etta into her bed with some old story about a boy magician and waited until my parents were asleep. Then I walked down our country lane toward Waycross. It was only a few miles, and the humid air did me good. The fireflies were out in force as it was dusk in early June. They glowed and dimmed rhythmically in the woods beside the Puffcrete strip of road, just like they'd done for 1,000 years or more. Walking in the cool darkness helped me think. A bit of solitude and some country quiet, it was good for the soul. My destination was a local bar with a single pool table and a regular crowd of perhaps 10. I knew them all pretty well, even though I only ventured into town once every week or two. I needed some beer, and I didn't want to drink alone tonight. My little communion with nature didn't last long. I'd only made it a mile or so down the road toward town when a car appeared behind me. I tensed up because the approach wasn't a normal one. The local folk out here drove cheap, rattling trams with old-fashioned tires. Hovering models and outright air cars were quite rare. This vehicle was too damned quiet. Trams whirred and chugged. This thing, whatever it was, glided over the Puffcrete like a ghost. On impulse, I stuck out my thumb and walked backwards, waving for the driver's attention as the vehicle approached. This gave me two advantages. One, if the car turned out to be trouble, I would at least be facing in the right direction when it reached me. Two, if they were friendly, they might give me a first-class ride. The vehicle slowed, and I forced a grin. The headlights played over me, blinding me. Were they checking me out or sizing me up? I couldn't be sure, so I kept grinning like a fool.
"Get in the car, McGill," a voice called out.
A head on a scrawny neck had poked out the window. I was greatly disappointed as I recognized the snotty voice that was speaking. It was none other than Primus Winslade. I lowered my hand and retracted my thumb. Walking up to the hatch, I looked him over. He sneered back. Winslade was a ferret of a man. He was Imperator Turov's butt boy, and he seemed to enjoy the role. "I was hoping it was Galena herself," I said.
"Don't call her that, adjunct."
It bugged Winslade that I had managed to be intimate with Turov on any number of occasions, certainly more often than he had, despite the fact he'd followed her around like a puppy most of his adult life. "I don't accept rides from strangers," I said, and I turned around and kept walking. Winslade rolled after me, his engine revving in annoyance.
"Get in this car! That's an order!" he shouted.
"I'm a legionnaire on furlong, not a hog," I told him. "Unless you're activating me and willing to pay, that is." Legionnaires worked differently than the regular hegemony military. While we were on active duty, we were paid handsomely. That was only right, as we tended to get killed a lot. But when we were languishing between contracts on Earth, we were paid a rather thin wage. In order to make me follow orders like a soldier, a hog had to, in effect, activate my contract. I was a bit surprised that Winslade didn't fume at me. He chuckled knowingly instead.
"Having some money troubles, then, are we?" he asked. "Perhaps I can help with that."
Just about anyone who's known me for long will tell you I'm slow on the uptake at times. Don't get me wrong, in combat I have fine reflexes. But when an unexpected social situation arose, I just seemed to have trouble figuring out what was happening right off. But my mind went click when Winslade let out that sly chuckle of his. The whole situation seemed fishy. Not 6 hours after I'd found out about my mom's condition, Winslade had arrived and tracked me down. I needed money for my mom, and he just happened to show up in my neck of the woods and mention money in a snide way. Now, all that could be 9 kinds of coincidence, but unfortunately, I don't believe in coincidences. I stopped walking and turned around toward Winslade, whose face was lit up by the green instruments inside his cockpit. My grin expanded on my face, and I gave him a thoughtful nod. "I'll take that ride after all, Primus." His ferret-like eyes narrowed for a second. Maybe, just maybe, he could sense the change in my thinking. Before, my grin had been friendly and unassuming. Now, however, it had taken on a predatory cast. The difference was subtle, but it was undeniable all the same. Chapter 4. The hatch on Winslade's vehicle popped open, and I climbed inside. He gripped the wheel, and the air car suddenly vaulted into the sky with a stomach-lurching thrum of sheer power. "This is Turov's baby, isn't it?" I asked.
"You should know it rather intimately."
He was right, of course. I'd taken liberties on a few occasions with Galena, right here on these supple, tank-grown leather seats. In fact, the interior of the vehicle had me remembering sweet visions of revelry. I sure was wishing she'd been the one to come out and pick me up instead of sending her repulsive minion. "Oh, come on," I told him. "Don't be sour about another man's conquests. After all, I happen to know you nailed her yourself in that very driver's seat." He looked startled.
"What are you talking about?" he snapped.
"Don't you remember? She told me all about it one time when we were having an afterglow drink together. The story was so vivid, it's almost like I was there myself, peeping from the back seat." Winslade's face pinched up into a sour expression.
"You're mistaken, McGill. You're drunk, aren't you?"
"What? Not a drop, I swear. But wait. You're right. It wasn't you Galena was talking about. It was another fella. Sorry." Winslade was positively pissed off now. That had been the goal of my bullshit story, after all.
"You must stop calling her Galena, or I'll drop you out of this air car from a mile up."
I gave him a booming laugh. It made him cringe a little. "I'd like to see you try to shove me out the hatch. Where the hell are we going, anyway?"
"Nowhere. I came down to talk in private. The car has been outfitted with a signal blocker."
I glanced at my tapper, and I saw he was right. It was blinking, and there was no repeater available for it to connect with. "So talk," I said.
"Here's the deal," he began. "Drusus will summon you shortly to Central. You will go there, as you must. But you will refuse the mission he has for you. Under no circumstances will you accept his offer for a special operation."
"Why not?" I asked. "I need money, as you seem to know."
"Yes, and you will be taken care of. You'll have all the money you need, and then some. You'll be able to pay for your mother's treatment and buy a car like this one with what's left over, if you want to."
I knew what was up at that point. He'd flat-out admitted he knew about my sick mama before I'd told him a thing. Winslade had made a crucial error. When a man got between me and my fortune or my girl, that was one thing. But to set up a situation where he could determine whether my own mama lived or died? Well, sir, that was a bridge too far in my book.
"Well," Winslade demanded, "what do you say? Have my words penetrated that Cro-Magnon skull of yours, or should I repeat them more slowly?"
He glanced over at me when I still didn't answer. He read my expression, and he knew he was in trouble. "It's my eyes. People tell me that sometimes I have the eyes of the dead. It's a legionnaire thing. The look of a primitive animal ready to commit murder. That look comes over a legion man when he's beyond angry. It usually appeared in the middle of deadly action, and it signified there were no longer any higher-level brain functions to get between a man and his hands. That there was nothing to slow a man down when it was go time." Winslade managed to tighten his grip on the steering wheel and spin it over hard to the left. We went into a spiraling dive. Warning lights flashed and alarms beeped all over the cab. My big hands caught him by the throat despite the fact he managed to bite my left thumb. Soon that same thumb was plunged 2 inches deep into the flesh of his throat. He didn't even have time to suffocate. I'd wrecked his larynx and broken up the cartilage of his windpipe. But strangulation takes too long in my book. I closed off his carotids and the blood stopped pumping to his brain. Seconds later, he was out. Unfortunately, we were too damn close to the ground by then. On impulse, I reached out and killed the car's engine. Some flashers were still going off irritatingly, but I ignored all that. It was too dark to see the trees below as they rushed up to meet us, but I could smell the pines when I popped open the cupola by tugging on the emergency loops. We were still falling, spinning, and the night sky outside was full of cold, glittering stars. In the distance, I thought I could pick out the glow of Atlanta's streetlights on the horizon. Damn, it was as fine a night to die as I'd ever seen. It was pretty country, and my only regret I could later recall was that my drastic action might start a forest fire. I hoped the recent rains would prevent the trees from lighting up. There was no point in even trying to survive the crash, so I unbuckled my belt and enjoyed the ride to the finish. I might even have whooped and hollered as we slammed down in a fiery mess somewhere in the Blue Ridge Mountains. But I don't remember that part. I only remember the intention to do some whooping. By killing the air car's power, I'd switched off whatever blocking system the vehicle had used to keep my tapper from connecting earlier. As my last conscious act, I pressed the emergency transmit button on my tapper. That caused a burst of packets to connect to the local network on the ground, and thereby update my mental state in the data core up at Central. Then, a few seconds later, I was dead once more. Reviving was nothing new to me. I'd done it more times than I could count. I like to think that every death I'd suffered had been for a good cause, even if I knew that wasn't true. My death in the air car crash I would forever account as a good one. Consequently, when I came out of the oven, or the flesh printer, or whatever the hell these alien contraptions really were, I was in an excellent mood. Those that were assembled to witness my rebirth, however, weren't in such fine spirits.
"McGill, you fuck!" Turov hissed into my ear. "Play dumb, or I'll destroy you."
I couldn't see her yet, and that was a damn shame. Galina Turov was a nightmare of a woman. She was about 20 years old, physically, but at least twice that in the mind. She'd been revived young, and she'd liked it, and kept the look. The result was kind of like having a prom queen with a vicious temper and a conniving attitude, ordering people around. In short, she was just the kind of woman I found myself spending too much time with as the years went by. Fortunately for both her and me, her request was one I was practically born and bred to perform.
"What happened?" I asked. "Did that fool Winslade blow up the air car?"
Big hands grabbed my arms and pulled me off the gurney. I stood, but weakly. My freshly regrown legs weren't quite ready to hold my weight yet. I swayed, leaning even more than I needed to against the orderlies that propped me up.
"McGill,"
another voice asked. This time I could see the blurry shape of the speaker. It was Equestrian Drusus, a smaller man with a regal bearing. Not so long ago, he'd briefly been placed in charge of all Earth's defenses during the war with the Cephalopod Kingdom. Politics and jealousy had not thwarted his authority, and now he was one step above Turov in rank. Squinting and rubbing at my eyes determinedly, I managed to see the 3 gold sunbursts on Drusus's shoulders. Standing at his side, with her arms crossed under her perky bosom, stood an angry-looking Galina Turov. She had only 2 sunbursts on her epaulets, and that's why she wanted me to say nothing about what Winslade had offered back in that ill-fated air car.
"Ah," I said, peering at her. "There you are. I seem to have a hangover this morning." "It's midday," Turov snapped.
I looked around at the 2 of them. "You left me dead for a while, huh? Why's that?"
"We were weighing our options," Turov said.
"That's not exactly true," Drusus said. "We had to investigate the cause of the crash before we revived each of you separately."
"What did the report say?"
I asked in a conversational tone. They narrowed their eyes at me. You have to understand that I had a certain reputation, well-deserved, of being a troublemaker.
"It was inconclusive," Turov said. "You tell us what happened."
"Well," I said thoughtfully, formulating my lie. Clearly, Turov didn't want me talking about how I was being offered a bribe to refuse Drusus's mission, whatever it was about. Many men in my position would have told the truth anyway, but that just wasn't my way. I tended to hold the truth in a vaunted position in my mind, as if it was some kind of lofty goal, a regal thing beyond the ken of mortal man. Instead, I smiled at them. Winslade said something about coming down to pick me up and bring me to Central, I said. I don't know why. Why don't you revive him and ask about it?
We'll do that in good time, Drusus said. But you must excuse me, McGill. I'm having trouble believing that this violent event was an accident. How exactly did you end up burnt to ash in a Georgia forest?
Well, I do live down there, I said. And I already told you why I was in the air car. The only mystery to me is why I crashed. Is there any sign it was shot down?
None.
Pilot error, then?
Turov relaxed and uncrossed her arms. She didn't exactly smile at me, but her face had softened. I was bullshitting, and that made her happy. Drusus, on the other hand, had a suspicious look on his face. He'd never been an easy man to fool.
McGill, I am capable of remembering recent events. You and Winslade have a particularly rocky history.
What? You mean about killing each other and so forth? That's old news. It's beneath any Legion Varus man to hold a grudge like that.
Just so. Very well, then.
He turned to the bio-adjunct running the revival machine. Revive Winslade. Contact me when the task is done.
He walked out then, and I watched him go with a slack expression. Turov came to stand nonchalantly nearby.
I know you blew up my air car, you dick, she whispered harshly.
I glanced down at her in feigned surprise. She glared back.
That's simply untrue, Imperata. I was aboard, I admit that. But as God is my witness, Winslade was driving. I think you should talk to him about it. Are you claiming you don't remember anything from that flight?
No, not really. I remember getting aboard, and I remember taking off. But once we were up there, my mind is a blank. Next thing I knew, I was popping out of the oven here at Central.
She licked her lips thoughtfully.
It could actually be true that you don't remember. Winslade might have used the blocker aboard my car.
Why, Imperata, I exclaimed. I'm surprised. Did you know those devices are illegal?
Shut up. Let me think. If Winslade was using the blocker, you would have no idea why the crash happened. But it still stands to reason that you caused it.
But why would I do that? I asked her with the most innocent, blank, dumbass look I could muster.
She sighed, and I could tell right then she believed me. The fine art of lying was all about playing your part to the hilt. You couldn't do it halfway. You had to be absolutely firm in your determination to obscure the truth. Any hesitancy, reluctance, or even a sense of amusement would give a man away every time.
Damn it, she said. If Winslade's mind is a blank, I'll never know which of you two assholes destroyed my air car.
Well, if it's any consolation, I'm mighty sorry about that fine vehicle of yours, sir.
That isn't any comfort at all, she said,
and she stalked away to the exit. I found some clothes and followed her out into the endless, echoing hallways of the giant pyramid-shaped building we called Central. Feeling pretty good, I whistled an old tune as I walked.
Chapter 5
Turov noticed me following her and caught me staring at her butt. That was something of a hobby of mine with an attractive woman, but in Turov's case, it was a real treat. She had a body that belied her rank and her personality. What's more, I was intimately familiar with every detail of it.
"I'm taking this elevator, adjunct," she said in an unfriendly tone, "and you're not coming with me."
"No, sir," I said. She stepped aboard the elevator and opened her mouth to tell it where she wanted to go, but I interrupted her. "I think I'll just head up to Drusus's office instead," I said. Her hand snapped out, catching the elevator door and pushing it back. It had just about closed in my face.
What?
She snapped. Well, when Winslade picked me up on the road back in Waycross, he said something about a mission Drusus wanted me to go on. I thought I would just head on up there to his floor and...
You will do no such thing,
she hissed, coming out of the elevator and glaring up at me. What do you suggest then, sir? She sighed, her small shoulders moved up and down in an exaggerated shrug.
All right, come with me. Keep quiet until we get to my office.
It was a nice, quiet ride up there. She kept her promise not to talk, and I did the same. It really wasn't a challenge for me. Turov, on the other hand, seemed to be squirming with questions. She wanted to know how much I knew and how much Winslade had told me before he went splat at my side. I could have told her, of course, but I wasn't in an informational mood. If there was one thing I'd learned from my fellow schemers in life, it was that keeping quiet often paid big dividends.
All right,
she said when I reached her office.
You can stop this farce.
Which one?
I mean stop pretending you don't know what's going on. You're playing me, and I don't appreciate it.
In my mind, I was the one being played. That's why I'd killed Winslade. He was a snake under the best circumstance, mind you, and deserved a good killing just on principle any day of the week. But in this case, he'd tipped his hand. Turov knew I was in financial trouble. That much was clear. What I suspected was much darker. I suspected she and Winslade had helped engineer my circumstances. I didn't think they'd made my mama sick, but they might have leaned on some government types to make sure her required treatment was out of my financial reach. Okay, I said after a brief delay. I'll stop pretending. She squinted at me suspiciously.
That's it?
Yup. She nodded.
Okay, play it that way. You're going to be summoned to Drusus. He will offer you a mission that will take you off-world. You will refuse that mission on the basis that your mother is sick and needs your care.
It was my turn to give her a suspicious stare. What do you know about my mama?
Nothing, she said. And I want to know even less. What I do want is for you to stay on Earth. For this simple act, your mother will receive the care she needs. Is that understood?
Are you threatening my mother's life, Imperator? I asked, with just a hint of danger in my voice. She turned away from me before answering and retreated behind her desk. I knew that was because I had a certain reputation for violent outbursts. Mind you, the recipients of these outbursts were always highly deserving of their fates.
That's why you killed Winslade, isn't it?
She asked me. What? I don't know. I died too, remember?
That doesn't absolve you of anything. I know you, McGill. You'd happily destroy yourself to avenge a slight from another.
I shrugged, unable to deny her words.
All right, it doesn't matter. The car was insured. I'll suffer with the deductible and the increased rates, but it doesn't matter. What I'm willing to offer you is what you really need. Your mother will get her treatment. All you have to do is refuse to accept Drusus's mission.
Well, now, I said, it might not be as simple as all that. What if he orders me to take the mission? He can do that, you know. She shook her head.
He won't. He wants a true volunteer.
With a sudden motion, I lifted my hands and slammed them together, making a booming clap. Turov jumped visibly, and her hand flew to the butt of her pistol. Well then, I said loudly, we're all good here. Thanks for filling me in, Imperator. She licked her lips nervously and eyed my sidearm as if making sure it was still in its holster. Slowly, she slid her hand away from her weapon and gave me a flickering smile.
Go visit Drusus now, she said. Don't hint that you know about the mission. Don't mention anything we've talked about here.
I nodded reassuringly and stepped out of her office. Her eyes followed me warily. Damn, did everyone think I was some kind of murderous psychopath? In the elevator on the way up to Drusus's office, I worked on my tapper. It had been quietly recording my conversation with Turov, and I wanted to make sure it had caught all the incriminating details. My final clap, in fact, had served to stop the recording. The sound was crisp and clear on the playback. I smiled, knowing I had a chip to bargain with at last. Drusus was in his office, and he barely looked up when I got past his staffers into his inner chambers. As was customary, I waited at attention in front of his desk. At last, making a wry face, he looked up from his work and faced me. "Adjunct James McGill," he said. "You're a hard man to gauge, do you know that?" "That's what people tell me, sir," I said. "Keeps my enemies guessing and my friends nervous." He chuckled and shook his head. "I have to admit, after this latest stunt, I almost changed my mind about meeting with you today." "Stunt, sir? You mean the accident?" "Yes, another deadly accident involving you and Winslade. What are the odds?" It was a damnably unusual wreck, I would argue. I suspect Winslade's driving first and Turov's poor schedule of maintenance second. Air cars aren't like trams, you know. You have to do more than just pour in a can of oil now and then." Drusus nodded sourly. "I thought you'd say something like that. Tell me, McGill, is Turov still breathing downstairs in her office?"
"Of course she is, sir. What are you suggesting?"
"Never mind. Here's the deal. I need you. I hate to admit it, but I need a man who gets things done no matter what stands in his way."
"In that case, I'm that man."
"Right. But don't you even want to hear what the mission is?"
"Not particularly, but I do want you to hear something."
I played the recording for him, implicating Turov and Winslade in a conspiracy. I figured that if I didn't even know what Drusus's mission was about, my case would be even stronger. I'd look like an innocent party, no mean feat for a man of my stature. Drusus listened, and his face darkened as the recording finished. He rubbed at his face. Instead of flying into a rage and ordering Turov to be arrested, however, he looked worried.
"I thank you for bringing that to my attention, McGill. I'd like to ask for a favor."
"What's that, sir?"
"Destroy that recording. It will only cause us greater trouble. In fact, it may already be too late."
My face went slack in incomprehension.
"I don't get it, sir."
"No, I don't either, not entirely. Let's just say that Turov has connections. Everyone knows that, but over the last couple of years since the cephalopod attack, I've become increasingly alarmed at her resiliency."
I'm not sure what you're talking about, Equestrian.
Have you ever wondered why she wasn't permed for her treasonous behavior during the cephalopod war?"
"I just figured she weaseled out of it somehow."
"It was more than that. Some people high up in our government, those who serve on the ruling council of hegemony itself, they're behind her."
"I see. That would explain a lot."
Drusus got up from his desk and paced behind it. While he did that, I pretended to dutifully erase the recording of Turov's voice. What I really did was change the name of the file and encrypt it. A man could never have too many aces up his sleeve, to my way of thinking.
"I know you had a close relationship with Nagata in the past," Drusus continued. "He was the man who sat in this very chair I'm in now."
I looked at the chair in question doubtfully. Nagata's office hadn't even been on this floor. Drusus caught my expression and shook his head.
"I meant that figuratively, not literally. I'm a 3-star officer with similar duties. I'm one of the few obstacles in between Turov and her personal goals."
"That didn't work out well for Nagata, did it?"
"No, sir.
He got his ass permed."
"Exactly. I don't intend to suffer the same fate. What I want to know is if you'll stand with me on this."
I looked at him in mild surprise. People tended to order me around or ask me to do things that were questionable in nature, but they rarely asked me to take a loyal stand.
"Well," I said, "I've always liked and respected you, sir.
even after you left the Legion and moved up to work here at Hogs Central.
That's very considerate, he said, and I couldn't tell if he was being sarcastic or not. But I'm asking for your support, in a personal way. Are you a man I can count on if things go badly around here? Again.
My first loyalty is to Earth, then my family, then Legion Varus, in that order, I said seriously. After that, though, I'm willing to call you a friend and stick my neck out to help if I can.
That's the most I can hope for, I guess. Thanks for the honest answer.
He pushed a small box across his desk toward me. I eyed the box, frowning. I didn't open it right away.
You sure you want to do this, sir? I asked him.
He met my eyes and nodded. I thought about bringing up my mom about then, but I didn't. It just seemed wrong to ask him for a political favor right now. He was talking about serious Legion business. Nothing about our discussion was private or personal. It was all appropriate, if unusual and outside of normal channels. After looking at the box, he'd scooted in my direction for a second. I scooped it up and opened it. A moment later, I took out the twin silver bars of a centurion. I'd been promoted, just like that. Somehow, I figured the promotion was only going to get me into deeper trouble. But I plucked the bars out of the box anyway and touched them to my lapels. They quickly consumed my adjunct's insignia, embedded themselves into the fabric, and stuck there. It was as if they'd been there my whole life. Chapter 6. Drusus never did tell me exactly what he wanted me to do for him. The precise nature of this mission I was supposed to go on wasn't even described. He did tell me, however, to report to the labs deep under the bedrock of Central in the morning, equipped for hazardous duty. I left his office worrying about my mom. If this activity ended up perming me, always a possibility when the word special was attached to any mission, there was no way she would survive to see Christmas. The thought of Etta and my dad spending a lonely Christmas together briefly crossed my mind. Then I got back to problem solving. As a man with a long history in the Legions, I wasn't completely without resources. I took it upon myself to contact certain people who might be able to help, or at least to steer me in the right direction. The first one to respond was Della. That was probably because we had a kid together, and she might have assumed it involved Etta. It was nice to know she cared in her own way.
"What's wrong, James?"
she asked, her face swimming into existence on my tapper.
"Nothing," I said.
"At least not with me or Etta."
"What's the problem, then? Wait, you're not calling for a date, are you? That ship has sailed, as you Earthers like to say." "No, no, nothing like that. I'm calling about my mama. She's sick."
"Really?"
"Yes. Now that I think about it, I think I knew that."
I frowned at her.
"Why?" "Because I've seen the look, a grayness to the face, a bloodless look. Does she bleed at night, inside?"
"Yeah," I said, amazed.
"How do you know that?"
She composed her thoughts and her eyes took on an unfocused look.
"Some of our people used to get like that back on Dustworld, but the last of them died off when I was a child."
I narrowed my eyes. "Not you, though. Not Natasha or Etta."
"It generally strikes the aged, but we have so few of them on my home planet."
I knew all too well why there weren't any old folks on Dustworld. Life there was just too harsh. Oh, there were a few old-timers around, like her father, the investigator, but one could argue he was far from a typical person.
"So what is it? What do you think is wrong with her?" "Nanites," she said. "They're everywhere, you know, in the dust, in the water, even in the cells of the plants and animals we eat. We developed them many decades ago, and the first colonies were wild. They escaped, some of them. Now they infest and feast on any host they can find." An involuntary shudder threatened to sweep through me, but I quelled the urge. You haven't seen death until you watch a grown man consumed alive by a swarm of nanites. It was like watching a dead thing decompose before your eyes.